7 o'clock on Saturday mornings. Tune in and get connected to the golden age of country music.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Galveston 89.5 HD2 and Huntsville at 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. The next election is scheduled for May 3rd, 2025, with early voting begin on April 22nd, which is only about 6 weeks from now. The deadline to apply for a mail-in ballot is April 22nd, which is only about 5 weeks. Voter registration applications or registration updates must be filled out and received by the county or state at least 30 days before the election date, which is before April 3rd, and is only about 3 weeks from now. You have been warned. You can register or update your voting information at harrisvotes.com if you live in Harris County, or at votetexas.gov for anywhere in Texas. I just learned about this nine-month-old story, but I feel it deserves some serious commentary. It's called Conn's Files for Chapter 11 Bankruptcy from RetailDive.com, July 24th of 24. Conn's Inc. on July 23rd filed for Chapter 11 in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of Texas. The company plans to wind down its business, including shuttering its entire fleet of over 550 stores. Prior to filing for bankruptcy, Conn's started going out of business sales at about 105 stores under its two banners, Conn's Home Plus and Badcock Home Furniture and More. The furniture and home goods retailer reported assets and liabilities, each ranging from $1 billion to $10 billion. The company's top five creditors are collectively owed more than $57 million. Overall, Conn said it has $200 million in obligations to trade and unsecured creditors and about $530 million in total funded debt obligations. The company is seeking court approval to complete going out of business sales by October 31st of 2024. Conn's is also seeking court permission to reject store leases per court filings. Conn's CEO, Norman Miller, said, quote, "A convergence of factors contributed to the decision to file for bankruptcy. The decision to acquire rival retailer W.S. Badcock late last year is one of them. The move generated costs that added to Conn's liquidity challenges," Miller said in court documents. Neil Saunders, managing director of Global Data, said in an email to Retail Dive, quote, "The acquisition of Badcock last year was arguably a mistake and has cost the company time and capital. Expanding in a very soft market was an error," unquote. While the height of the COVID-19 pandemic generated a spike in consumer spending on home decor purchases, increasing inflation and interest rates have dampened discretionary buying, Miller said. Saunders said, quote, "Conn's is very much a victim of the slowdown in demand for home goods. Because consumers are under financial pressure and because they're not moving home as much as they once did, sales have slumped. The impact of these things has been sharper on Conn's than for other retailers, partly because it has a lot of consumers on more modest incomes who rely on credit, which is now more expensive to service," unquote. According to Conn's, about 61% of purchases were financed through Conn's in-house credit program during the company's 2024 fiscal year, 23% were financed through third-party or lease-to-own terms, and about 16% of purchases were made with cash or credit cards. Conn's, this is important, Conn's relied on the issuance of debt to support its cash flows for operations and strategic initiatives in recent years. However, due to increasing interest rates, Miller said interest rates expenses increased from about $26 million for the year ended January 31 of 21 to nearly $83 million for the year ended January 31 of 24. Of the $77 million Conn said it spent on 350 leases in fiscal 2024, over $35 million of that figure was related to underperforming stores. The merger with Badcock also resulted in some redundant store locations, exacerbating what the company termed location functionality. The increase in interest rates and cost of capital, coupled with the prospect of minimal to no relief in the near term, has negatively affected the company's ability to manage its debt obligations, Miller said. Conn's began selling appliances in Texas in 1937. At the time of its bankruptcy filing, the company said it employed about 3,800 people and had 553 corporate and dealer retail stores across 15 states, 22 distribution and service centers, and 6 corporate offices. Badcock was founded in 1904 in Florida. Before its deal with Conn's, the company had 64 corporate locations and 310 independent dealer-owned stores. Italics in the blog post version of the story are mine. Regular listeners to this show might recall that I was really upset when Sears filed for bankruptcy. At that time, I discussed how Sears was a victim of vulture capitalism and a typically predatory leveraged buyout. My feelings about the Conn's bankruptcy are just the reverse. Having just recently learned that they'd been going out of business for almost a year, I admit to being happy about it. Their bankruptcy is good for consumers and good for the communities in which the stores did business, and I'll go into the reasons why, at least some of them. When I worked for Conn's for a few months in 2008 and 2009, the prices at Conn's were competitively low, but I quickly concluded that Conn's main business model was not selling products, but rather the very high interest credit loans they offered. I hated working there. I felt the company was a predatory lender. Conn's was a different kind of vulture capitalism in that they preyed on customers of modest means and poor credit. I hated that they trained me to do their predatory sales to people who really couldn't afford it. The credit terms weren't legally usurious, but they were certainly morally usurious. I often found myself subtly discouraging some people from accepting these promotional credit terms, but people were either in dire need, like for a refrigerator, or they simply wouldn't be helped. I'll give you an example. When someone came in with a low credit score, which was their main customer demographic, they would be offered terms like 50% down and 36 months to pay the balance at a rate of about 35% a year, as I recall, which of course compounds monthly. Now that was bad enough, but then the credit predation could go a step further. Let's say the customer had previously bought and financed an appliance at Conn's and had been making payments for 18 months. I was trained to offer to wrap the remaining balance into a new loan for 36 months. The idea was to make the total monthly payment lower for the customer, and that's how we were supposed to pitch it. But what Conn's was actually doing was a form of debt entrapment, turning the original 36-month loan into a 54-month loan at morally usurious rates, while adding a new 36-month loan for the new purchase, which was also at morally usurious rates. If credit was offered to low-score individuals with a substantial down payment and a line of credit on the balance, this isn't automatically a bad thing. In fact, it can allow folks to buy things they urgently need with finance plans that no one else offered. Consider that usually if someone wants to buy an item with a financing offer, it's typically an all-or-nothing proposition in that you're approved for credit or you're not. In this sense, Conn's was acting as a seller-slash-lender of last resort, and that can benefit a community if done ethically. I never felt it was being done ethically, so my feeling is good riddance to Conn's. I will offer this thought, though. Being a lender of last resort is sometimes valuable for consumers. It not only helps the lender fill a need, it can also provide an opportunity for consumers to improve their credit score by paying the loan faithfully and in full. Unfortunately, the offer usually comes with predatory terms. Maybe this is an area where a nonprofit lender slash credit advisor could be useful, lending money at lower terms with substantial down payments. It's just a thought. You're listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 90% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. Or on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. There's more information on our Facebook page at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig, and you can look for me on Threads and Blue Sky at Thinkwing Radio. Now, if you want to get a little angry at right-wing hypocrisy, there's this story from the Texas Tribune. Transgender staffer navigates Texas Capitol with guarded care amid growing hostilities. For Mo Jenkins, working in the Texas Capitol is a dichotomy. In one moment, a House representative may be rallying against transgender rights, and in the next, the same lawmaker will stop by Jenkins' office for a friendly chat. The phenomenon isn't surprising, Jenkins said, but it can be confusing. As one of only a few openly transgender staffers working in the state capitol, the duality comes with the work she now does as chief of staff for a freshman lawmaker. Jenkins said, quote, "It's very ironic in a way to watch members essentially say that you're not human and deserve to not have health care and not exist in public, to them then wishing you a happy birthday and clapping you on your back or coming to your office and eating your gumbo." I have to pause here for a moment to comment on this behavior. Mo Jenkins is in an impossible position here. She's almost forced to view this behavior charitably to survive and function effectively in the Capitol, but that shouldn't excuse it. Legislators who are trying to pass bills that discriminate against Mo Jenkins, who say hateful things that apply to Mo Jenkins, and that literally try to oppress Mo Jenkins, but who then chat amiably with her and wish her a happy birthday, these are horrible human beings. But it's important to confront the question of what would be better. Should these people also be hateful to Mo Jenkins' face? Should Mo Jenkins be visibly angry at them for their hateful statements and legislative behavior? That would be honest, sure, but what would that do to Mo's ability to function effectively in the Capitol, and how would that scenario affect her mental health? Just thinking about it makes me angry on her behalf. That having been said, I'll continue with the story. In the 5 years Jenkins has worked in the Capitol, anti-trans legislators have made significant headway in their efforts to both restrict the rights of trans people and make their presence more vocal across state and federal offices. In Texas, lawmakers are making second passes at previous restrictions, like access to bathrooms, and going further than before, like expanding bans on funding for gender transition care. Even as the spread of legislation that could impact major aspects of her life grows, Jenkins wants to remain a part of the legislative process while she wrestles to work with those whom she says actively disrespect her. Jenkins said, quote, "A thing that I've struggled with a lot more, especially as a chief, is how do you find common ground with someone who does not even believe in your existence?" Unquote. Jenkins began working in the Texas Capitol with an internship with former state Representative Abel Herrero, Democrat of Robstown, in 2019. Since that first internship, Jenkins has served a variety of roles, committee clerk and director, and legislative aide. In several cases, she's been the first trans person to serve in those positions, including her current position as chief of staff for Representative Lauren Ashley Simmons, Democrat of Houston. But as Jenkins moved up in the Capitol, far-right lawmakers did too, gaining significant ground in the legislature and across the country. With a 2025 session well underway, the 26-year-old said she's never seen the Capitol in such a divisive state. Beyond policy shifting more aggressively against trans people, the tension in the Capitol is now palpable, and Jenkins and other LGBTQ plus staffers are unsure if they're even welcome in certain representatives' offices. Jenkins said, quote, "It's very ugly, and it's scary, because you're walking around this building and you kind of don't know who your friends are anymore," unquote. Representative Brian Harrison, Representative Midlothian, filed a bill in the House that would ban state funding from being used for gender-affirming surgery or medication that advocates have said unnecessarily bars trans Texans from receiving care. Harrison said him being called anti-trans because of the bill is unfair, as it stems from financial incentive, not disrespect. Harrison said in an interview Thursday with the Tribune, quote, "I don't actually view that bill from that perspective. Bills like that, for me, they don't come with any bearing or judgment on how you feel about those things," unquote. Now imagine me rolling my eyes and grunting with exasperation, but continuing. Changes have materialized outside the Capitol's walls as well. In 2024, the Department of Public Safety began blocking trans Texans from changing the listed gender marker on their driver's licenses. An executive order issued on President Donald Trump's first day in office also prevents federal IDs from having the listed gender be changed. Jenkins has a U.S. passport that lists her as a woman, but her state-issued identification lists her as a man. She says the disparity has been stressful for her, but so far it's been without issue. Even amid the increasing animosity toward a fundamental part of her identity, Jenkins said she has, quote, only honor and reverence, unquote, for the Capitol. Her political career and passion for public service are guided by her own life experiences. Her mother died of heart failure in 2012, and Jenkins said she was homeless after living on her own for over a year while in school before being adopted by her best friend's family. Jenkins said her identity as a trans woman is just one piece of her life, not even the largest, that shapes her goals in politics. Jenkins said, quote, I care a lot more about health care. I care a lot more about higher education and access to higher education. I care about homelessness because I used to be homeless when I was a teen. There's a lot more that I care about or am knowledgeable about, unquote. But the public sentiment shifting further away from trans people doesn't just concern Jenkins as a person. It also bleeds into her job. There are little moments that instill hope, a lighthearted conversation or a shared meal with Republican staffers, but there are divides widening as well, especially among the new, more conservative class of representatives. Jenkins said, quote, especially as a lot more conservative representatives have gotten elected, it's a lot harder to maintain those relationships that I built with their predecessors and those offices. A lot of my focus has had to really hone in on lobbyists and some of those mid to senior staff on really trying to let them know, hey, I'm a person. I'm also a resource, unquote. Those with antagonistic views on trans people aren't the only people who need reminding, Jenkins said. After Herrero announced his retirement and Jenkins was searching for new opportunities, a lawmaker approached her about being their chief of staff solely because Jenkins was trans. Jenkins says that experience was degrading in the face of her wealth of experience. Jenkins said, quote, it's something that I've repeatedly said to Democrats and to Republicans alike. Don't obsess over the fact that I'm trans or that there are trans people here, but obsess over the fact that we do really good work, unquote. For Simmons, a freshman representative with a background in union organizing but with fewer Capitol inroads, Jenkins' identity was never a thought in the hiring process. Rather, Jenkins' experience from years in the Capitol is what guided Simmons to hire her. Simmons said, quote, it was really about just having somebody who had that institutional knowledge and those relationships and aligned with the direction that I wanted to take the office and our values in our district, unquote. There are two family restrooms in the Capitol extension across from each other at the bottom floor. Jenkins, who uses only those gender-neutral bathrooms rather than the women's restroom, dreaded having to go from Herrero's fourth-floor office down six floors just to feel safe. Jenkins said, quote, every little thing that I do, I'm always thinking, how is it going to be perceived? How would people relay this? How are people going to talk about this? I wish that I could just walk through the world and never have to think about it, unquote. With Simmons's office located in the extension, Jenkins is glad a restroom is just one floor away, but the fear of being harassed or accused of improper behavior is a lingering fear for Jenkins and one she extends to other trans staffers in the Capitol who may choose to use the gendered bathrooms. A refocus on bathroom use was bolstered in the U.S. Congress when Representative Nancy Mace, a Republican of South Carolina, filed a bill that passed seeking a bathroom restriction in the Capitol. May said in a November interview with media outlets the ban absolutely targeted the House's first openly trans lawmaker, Representative Sarah McBride. Some legislators in Texas are seeking to emulate Mace's restrictions, as 20 representatives co-authored an amendment in the House rules that would similarly restrict bathroom usage. Harrison, one of the co-authors of the amendment, said he was frustrated Texas couldn't follow in Congress's footsteps. Harrison said, quote, it's outrageous to me that leadership in the Texas government has not managed to do what the leadership in the federal government has, which is require you to use the bathroom that comports with your gender, unquote. But gay and gender nonconforming staff have been in the Capitol long before Jenkins or any would-be bathroom bans and have worked to help shape the state with or without recognition, Jenkins said. As someone who is outspoken about her trans identity, having others around her is a welcome comfort. Jenkins said, quote, I think it's also about finding your tribe and creating small pockets of joy. There are a lot of LGBTQ staffers, whether they're out or not. We're all in the building. For Jenkins, her connection to the Capitol and the Texas legislature runs deeper than her job. Jenkins transitions from teenager to adult, from student to professional, from privately trans to public, are inseparable from the Capitol, thus becoming increasingly hostile to her very existence, she said. Working in a legislature that has scrutinized her existence has influenced her transition, especially after laws like SB 14 and 15 were passed in 2023. Some incidents make Jenkins and her family worried for her safety at times. Despite the concerns from her family and friends, Jenkins is simply unable to pull herself away from working in the Capitol. To her, working alongside the state's representatives is the best thing she can do to make life safer for everyone else in Texas. With committee assignments in and the House's 60-day restriction on passing bills soon coming to an end, Jenkins said she's prepped and ready to dig into the demanding work of the two committees on which Simmons sits. To do the work well, Jenkins is hoping lawmakers can put respect for their peers ahead of their political views. Jenkins said, quote, "Even if you think that my being is an ism, like a transgenderism, whatever you think it is, I as a human being have been through a lot of different things, so all I'm asking for is respect. At the end of the day, that's all I want," unquote. As long as this story is, I struggle to shorten it some. I encourage you to click on the story link I'm providing in the show post and read it at the Texas Tribune. Many years ago, I crystallized my view of the world. Basically, there's lots of stuff I don't understand for many reasons. I haven't experienced it, or I haven't been exposed to it, or my inclinations and internal life just can't identify with it. At some point, I concluded that none of that really mattered from my perspective as long as those people don't actually harm me. It was enough to accept that certain things about people and about the world simply are what they are and must be dealt with or tolerated. People are different, sometimes in ways that we can't internalize. That doesn't mean we can't accept them and treat them as people. Some folks are basically unhappy or hostile or aggressive. That's their nature, and the people around them have to cope or leave them be. Some folks are gay or transgender or intersex or whatever. That's their personal lives, and at the end of the day, they're just people trying to live their lives as peacefully, satisfyingly, and happily as they can, just like the rest of us. There's a saying that your freedom ends at the tip of my nose. Well, the reverse is equally true. Our freedom ends at the tip of their nose. A fundamental principle I live by is equality under the law. That means that laws that single out and favor or discriminate against a class of people for no good reason are unacceptable. I cannot understand why these laws survive legal challenges. It's obvious that we need an equal rights amendment to the Constitution and that it be interpreted broadly. In a related story from NBCNews.com, Texas bill would make identifying as transgender a felony punishable by jail. A Texas state bill could charge transgender people with gender identity fraud, making it illegal to identify as trans on official documents and potentially leading to jail time. The bill, which was filed last week by Republican State Representative Tom Oliverson, would make it a state jail felony if a person, quote, knowingly makes a false or misleading verbal or written statement, unquote, by identifying their sex assigned at birth incorrectly to a governmental entity or to their employer. State jail felonies in Texas are punishable by up to 2 years in jail and a fine of up to $10,000. Oliverson did not immediately return a request for comment. So far, the bill has no other co-sponsors, making it unlikely to pass, according to Cron, a sister website of the Houston Chronicle. However, the bill is among the first of its kind nationally and is an example of how legislation targeting trans people has become more clear in its intent and more extreme in recent years, particularly in Texas. Last month, Texas State Representative Brent Money, a Republican, filed a bill that would make it illegal for a health care provider to treat any patient, including adults, with puberty-suppressing medication, hormone therapy, or surgeries if the purpose of the treatment is to affirm the patient's gender identity. Money's bill is a replica of a law enacted in 2023 that prohibits such treatments for minors. The text of the new bill shows the word child struck out and replaced with person to apply to adults. The bill would also prohibit medical institutions from receiving public funds if they provide any such treatments. Money did not immediately return a request for comment. After filing the bill, he said on X that the measure is intended to expand the law restricting care for minors. Money, referring to the medical term for the severe emotional distress caused by the misalignment between one's gender identity and birth sex, said, quote, "I want to make it clear that my heart goes out to those struggling with gender dysphoria. These individuals deserve compassion, support, and real solutions to address their pain, not irreversible procedures that leave them scarred for life. This legislation isn't about judgment. It's about accountability," unquote. Now, in my opinion, actually at its heart, in his, I'm sure, it's entirely about judgment. But continuing. Money added that the bill targets doctors and medical profiteers, as he puts them, who, quote, "exploit vulnerable people, pushing costly surgeries and lifetime pharmaceuticals for financial gain rather than offering genuine care," unquote. However, most if not all major medical associations in the U.S., including the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Psychological Association, all support transition-related care for both minors and adults and oppose restrictions on it. Multiple studies have found that access to transition-related care, including surgeries for adults, improves mental health outcomes. Last year, the National Center for Transgender Equality, which is now called Advocates for Trans Equality, released the largest nationwide survey of the trans community with more than 90,000 respondents and found that 94% responded that they were at least a little more satisfied with their lives. Texas has provided a blueprint over the last decade for states that have sought to restrict trans rights, becoming in 2017 one of the first states, alongside North Carolina, to consider a bathroom bill which would have barred trans people from using the bathrooms aligned with their gender identities. The bill didn't pass, but the state has enacted other measures targeting trans people. In March 2022, after failing to pass a bill restricting transition-related care for minors, the state's attorney general issued a legal opinion that resulted in the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services opening child abuse allegations into parents who were suspected of having provided such care to their minor children. The state went on to pass a transition-related care restriction, and it has also enacted a measure barring trans student athletes from playing on school sports teams that align with their gender identities, among others. Additionally, the state recently announced that an executive order signed by Donald Trump bars it from allowing trans people to update the gender marker on their Texas birth certificates, state IDs, and driver's licenses. So far this year, Texas lawmakers have introduced nearly 170 state bills targeting LGBTQ people, according to Equality Texas, a state LGBTQ advocacy group. These include a new bathroom bill supported by a majority of the Texas House. Martin Niemöller famously said, quote, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." That's all true, and maybe increasingly true in the United States under Trumpism, and this is no different. We might update it for this current situation in our country. If I may, first they came for the transsexuals, and I did not speak out because I was not a transsexual. Then they came for the homosexuals and lesbians, and I did not speak out because I was not a homosexual and lesbian. Then they came for the pro-Gaza activists, and I did not speak out because I was not a pro-Gaza activist. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Let me be clear. When a government starts to oppress or single out one group, they are really suppressing and oppressing all groups. This brings me to the subject of official oppression. I'm no lawyer, so take this as you wish, but in Texas, official oppression is defined under the Texas Penal Code, Title 8, Offenses Against Public Administration, Chapter 39, Abuse of Office, and I've linked to that URL in my blog post for this show. Here's what it says. Section 39.03, Official Oppression. A. A public service servant acting under color of his office or employment commits an offense if he, 1. Intentionally subjects another to mistreatment or to arrest, detention, search, seizure, dispossession, assessment, or lien that he knows is unlawful, or 2. Intentionally denies or impedes another in the exercise or enjoyment of any right, privilege, power, or immunity, knowing his conduct is unlawful, or 3, intentionally subjects another to sexual harassment, or 3B, for purposes of this section, this is, I think, the important part, a public servant acts under color of his office or employment if he acts or purports to act in an official capacity or takes advantage of such actual or purported capacity. And then there's 3C. In this section, sexual harassment means unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, or other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature, submission to which is made a term or condition of a person's exercise or enjoyment of any right, privilege, power, or immunity, either explicitly or implicitly. And then 3D, an offense under this section is a Class A misdemeanor, except that an offense is a felony of the third degree if the public servant acted with the intent to impair the accuracy of data reported to the Texas Education Agency through the Public Education Information Management System described by sections blah, 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 under a law requiring that reporting. So that's that. Now, as a non-lawyer, I think that an enterprising civil rights attorney might actually be able to make a case that when Texas legislators propose laws that inhibit the constitutional rights and freedoms of any minority, which should include sexual and gender minorities, those legislators are at least attempting to act in the capacity of official oppression or as official oppressors under state law, as I cited above. Additionally, it might be argued that anyone who attempts to enforce such legislation, if passed, is engaging in official oppression under color of law. If there are any lawyers listening to this show, I'd love to hear from you on this matter. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible, and some may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, smaller, in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too. Now, continuing with what seems to be a theme from TheHill.com, Republican adjourns hearing after blow-up over a McBride introduction. A House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee hearing ended abruptly Tuesday after Representative Keith Self, Republican of Texas, referred to Representative Sarah McBride, Democrat of Delaware, the first transgender person elected to Congress, as Mr. Self, who chairs the Subcommittee on Europe, introduced McBride as, quote, the congressman from Delaware, unquote, during a hearing on arms control and U.S. assistance to Europe. McBride responded by calling Self Madam Chair. As McBride delivered her remarks, Ranking Member Bill Keating, Democrat of Massachusetts, interjected, asking Self to repeat his introduction. Quote, Mr. Chairman, you are out of order, Keating said. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency? I mean, I've come to know you a little bit, but this is not decent, unquote. Self responded, quote, we will continue this hearing, unquote. Keating responded, quote, you will not continue it with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way, unquote. Self then adjourned the meeting. In a post on the social platform X, Self said, quote, it is the policy of the United States to recognize two sexes, male and female, referring to an executive order President Trump signed during his first hours back in office. Spokespeople for Keating and McBride did not immediately return requests for comment. Self's intentional misgendering of McBride is not the first time the first-term lawmaker has faced jabs from her Republican colleagues over her identity. On February 7th, ahead of McBride's first floor speech, Representative Mary Miller, Republican of Illinois, introduced McBride, quote, as the gentleman from Delaware, unquote. McBride brushed off Miller's introduction. Quote, for what it's worth, there's an entire speech after I'm recognized by the acting speaker that's worth a watch more than the 15-second video of me being called on, she wrote on X after a video of the introduction went viral. Other House GOP members have referred to McBride as a man on social media and moved to bar her from women's restrooms on Capitol grounds. In interviews and social media posts, McBride has called Republicans' targeting of her and the trans community, quote, an attempt to distract, unquote, from issues like the rising cost of living. McBride told CBS News' Face the Nation in a November interview, quote, I think we're all united that attempts to attack a vulnerable community are not only mean-spirited, but really an attempt to misdirect, unquote. Still, McBride has signaled a willingness to work with Republicans in Congress. She introduced her first bill, legislation to tackle fraudulent practices in the credit repair industry, with Representative Young Kim, a California Republican. To me, this is just another example of oppression by a self-righteous person to deprecate another person because of their own sense of disapproval. Truly, how Representative Self feels about how Representative McBride lives her life is none of his damn business. Further, as a co-equal branch of government, I don't believe that any executive orders by Trump are binding on how Congress conducts itself. Congress creates its own rules of decorum, for better or worse. Next, from HuffPost.com, Jewish Americans are sick of Trump exploiting them. Whether it's in the halls of power or out in the streets, Jewish Americans are uniting against the abduction of Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil and demanding the Trump administration stop its free speech crackdown under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. A dozen Jewish organizations, including some pro-Israel groups, called Thursday for Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to stop efforts to detain and deport those who are student visa holders or legal permanent residents without due process, according to a letter first obtained by HuffPost. Quote, in the past, laws and policies that limit the right to free speech have often been wielded against the Jewish community, and we're worried that we're seeing signs that they are being wielded against Muslim, Arab, and other minority communities now, unquote, the letter said, particularly expressing concern for Khalil. A green card holder himself, Khalil and his pregnant wife had just reached their university-owned apartment in New York City on Saturday when federal immigration agents took him without a warrant and sent him to a detention center in Louisiana. The Columbia University graduate was abducted for helping lead anti-war student protests last year on campus and has not been charged with a crime. New Jewish Narrative President Hadar Suskind told HuffPost, quote, President Trump is dressing up his assault on free speech and due process as if it was about fighting anti-Semitism. That's a lie. Trump is exploiting very real concerns about rising anti-Semitism to mask his anti-democratic agenda. As a Jew, I am offended and worried, unquote. Hundreds of Jewish New Yorkers, including rabbis and activists, demonstrated on Thursday in support of Khalil and in opposition of the Trump administration weaponizing their Jewish identity to further crush free speech. The protesters wore red shirts saying, quote, not in our name, unquote, while staging a sit-in at the Trump Tower's lobby. About 100 protesters were arrested in the demonstration, according to Jewish Voice for Peace. Khalil's abduction is, quote, further proof that we are on the brink of a full takeover by an authoritarian regime, unquote, said Jane Hirschman, whose grandfather and uncle were kidnapped by the Nazis during the Holocaust. She continued, quote, as Jews of conscience, we know our history and we know where this leads. This is what fascists do as they cement control. This moment requires all people of conscience to take bold action to resist state violence and repression. Free Mahmoud now, unquote. Khalil's lawyers attended a hearing on Wednesday to argue for bringing the activist back to New York. The judge did not decide on whether to bring him back from Louisiana, but maintained that he not be deported until his pending habeas corpus petition is reviewed. Quote, Jewish leaders need to ask themselves if they're willing to allow our community to be used in this way to dismantle democratic norms, said Rabbi Jill Jacob, CEO of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Quote, if the answer is no, their condemnation of this arrest should be loud and swift, unquote. Forgive me as I again read this quote by Martin Niemöller because it applies here as well. First, they came for the socialist, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionist, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. I'm pro-Israel, but against Benjamin Netanyahu and his fascistic government, just like I'm pro-American, but against Donald Trump and his fascistic government. I have no affection for the so-called pro-Palestine movement and much of its veiled calls for another Jewish Holocaust in Israel, but that doesn't mean that I can't see official oppression here when it happens. Unfortunately, this emergence of official oppression against unpopular people or minorities or causes seems to be a constant thread throughout today's show and currently throughout today's America. 25 years ago, I was saying that racism had become as unfashionable as spitting on the sidewalk, but that was then. Extreme right-wingers, proto-fascists, have taken us back to hateful times that I thought we'd mostly gotten past. Over the decades, I've often wondered how otherwise patriotic Germans in the 1930s could find the reasons and courage to so actively oppose their Nazi government at great personal risk to themselves. Indeed, many of these anti-Nazi activists were ultimately arrested, tortured, and then executed. I feel that's where we're heading now. American protesters today do not face the dire consequences the anti-Nazi Germans faced, at least not yet. But make no mistake, we are living through an era that falls squarely into the old belief that it cannot happen here. It can, and it is, and there are powerful people and forces that are working to accomplish it. It will take a lot of work, and in some cases personal risk, to combat it. Next from BBC.com, Arlington Cemetery strips content on black and female veterans from its website. Arlington National Cemetery has scrubbed from its website information and educational materials about the history of black and female service members. Some of the content unpublished from the site was on veterans who had received the nation's highest military recognition, the Medal of Honor, according to military news site Task and Purpose. The content removal is part of a larger effort by President Donald Trump to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, practices in the military and throughout the federal government. Because equity, who wants that? Approximately 400,000 veterans are buried in the Army-run cemetery, which was established after the U.S. Civil War at the home of the South's General Robert E. Lee. On the cemetery's website, internal links that directed users to web pages with information from the, quote, notable graves, unquote, of dozens of black, Hispanic, and female veterans were missing on Friday. The pages contained short biographies about veterans such as General Colin L. Powell, the first black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is the highest rank in the military after the president. They also told the stories of members of the Tuskegee Airmen, the country's first black military airmen. Earlier this year, the Defense Department had to reinstate training materials on the revered airmen after a national outcry over their removal following Trump's orders on DEI. Information on Hector Santa Anna, a World War II bomber pilot and career military leader who has been called a hero of the war, has been taken down as well. Visitors to the site may also have trouble finding information, as links to major sections have disappeared. It no longer lists pages for African American history, Hispanic American history, and women's history. Content still exists on some notable women buried there, including former Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and 14 veterans from the unit recently featured in the Oscar-nominated movie The 6-888, but it's only found from a direct search. Since re-entering the White House, President Donald Trump has signed multiple executive orders banning DEI within the federal government. A spokesperson for the cemetery said in a statement it was working to restore links and content remained, quote, committed to sharing the stories of military service and sacrifice to the nation, unquote, according to the Washington Post. It added that it wanted to ensure that the content aligned with Trump's orders and also with instructions from Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. Kind of like the diabolical duo. But continuing, Representative Adam Smith, the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, condemned the content removal. Smith said in an interview with the New York Times, quote, "The whole thing is deeply concerning. Even if you have concerns about the way DEI was handled in a number of different places, I've never seen a problem within the military," unquote. Trump has made dramatic changes in the military in his second term, including firing the country's top general, C.Q. Brown, a black man who had supported diversity in the armed forces. Secretary Hegseth, a former Fox News host and military veteran, has pledged to root out all diversity initiatives and had accused General Brown of being woke. There are over 2 million people serving in the U.S. military on active duty or in reserves, with 30% identifying as part of a minority group such as Black or Native American, and 18% as Hispanic or Latino, according to the Defense Department report. One-fifth of those in the military are women. This is just another petty, hateful example of white male supremacism in the current U.S. regime. I don't see how this country can survive another 45 months of this government and survive without being permanently damaged. Our country has already been permanently scarred. Where is the law and order part of the Republican Party when we actually need them? You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Sundays at 1 p.m. and re-airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. Again, that number is 713-526-5738 extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Blue Sky at Think Wing Radio. This next article is written in first person, and I'm going to read it that way. It's from MsMagazine.com, called "The GOP's Next Target, No-Fault Divorce and Women's Right to Leave." I'll note it's also about men's right to leave, even though that isn't specifically addressed. While America's blamer-in-chief foments a culture of finding fault, blaming Democrats for the L.A. fires, DEI for plane crashes, and immigrants for high housing prices, those of us who care about women's and children's rights are justly concerned about the future of no-fault divorce. Although no-fault divorce hasn't gotten to President Donald Trump's chopping block yet, rumors have proliferated and people are justifiably anxious. Amanda Monte wrote in her newsletter Mad Woman, quote, "No-fault divorce was one of many internet searches that surged in the days following the election. On TikTok, divorce coaches and influencers urged women to get divorced while they still could. Some divorce lawyers offered anecdotal evidence that divorce filings were already on the rise," unquote. The article's author continues, "I feel a cold chill reading about these things. My divorce 5 years ago was painful, but because New York State has no-fault divorce laws, the last state to adopt this, at least we didn't have to codify our private struggles within a punitive framework. As of 2010, every state in the U.S. has instituted no-fault divorce, which does not require proof of wrongdoing. Much of our economy, from housing prices to child care availability, is designed around the unit of straight married couples. Of course, an administration devoted to shuttering social services wants to shore up the institution of marriage. No-fault divorce sets a legal precedent for ending marriage without sinking into a morass of enmity. It's a law that makes space, in other words, for divorce without blame. Once upon a time, when things were great, I suppose, couples looking to end their marriage had to pick something on which to blame their divorce from a set list of legally justifiable reasons, like adultery, domestic abuse, or criminal behavior. This led to a lot of crafty lying and divorce tourism for those with resources. And for the less resourced, more vulnerable people, it often meant staying in marriages they didn't want to be in, including the people who needed most urgently to get away, like women who were actually being abused by their husbands. For some, this is a matter of life and death. A 2006 study published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics found that no-fault divorce, quote, increases the likelihood that a domestic violence relationship ends and acts to transfer bargaining power toward the abused, unquote. In fault-based divorce, one of the parties can contest the other's claims in court, a frightening possibility for a victim of abuse. No-fault divorce legislation also correlates with an 8-16% decline in female suicide, roughly a 30% decline in domestic violence for both men and women, and a 10% decrease in women murdered by their partners. Research has shown, quote, the most dangerous time for women experiencing abuse is when they attempt to escape, unquote. Evidence in favor of simplifying and potentially hastening divorce proceedings. But while this is obviously important, part of the ethos behind no-fault divorce is that it shouldn't have to be a life-or-death matter in order for people to choose divorce. One of my favorite facts about no-fault divorce is that it was first ushered into law in 1969 by a divorced politician called Ronald Reagan, who you might recall was in fact a Republican. The California Family Law Act introduced the grounds of, quote, irreconcilable differences. Under this precedent, no one's fault had to be established, and couples could avoid the long, expensive, and bitter process of placing the blame on one or the other of them. Reagan said at the time, quote, I believe it's a step towards removing the acrimony and bitterness between a couple that is harmful not only to their children, but also to society as a whole, unquote. He had just been through a bitter sideshow of a divorce from his first wife and knew of what he spoke. But some are now wondering if this law will go the way of Roe v. Wade, thanks to Reagan's own party. Vice President J.D. Vance's view of divorce is, quote, that people do it too easily, shifting spouses like they change their underwear, unquote, the Washington Post reports. Republican and conservative lawmakers are threatening to, quote, eliminate or at least narrow laws that allow couples to divorce without having to prove one person was to blame, unquote. Influential podcasters and right-wing activists, only some of them known abusers, along with politicians in Texas, Nebraska, and Louisiana, have called for the restriction or elimination of no-fault divorce. House Speaker Mike Johnson has said it's too easy to get divorced, which is spoken like someone who has never gotten divorced, suggesting that no-fault divorce laws are immoral and somehow responsible for school shootings, another gambit in the party's bizarre blame game. Organizations like the National Center for Men claim that no-fault divorce is, quote, a disaster mostly for men since most breakups are initiated by women, unquote. Why would that be? Well, studies have found that married men live longer, healthier lives than single men and have more leisure time than their wives. On the other hand, divorced women report more life satisfaction post-divorce. As Joanna Grossman, a professor of family law at SMU Dedman School of Law in Texas, told Slate, men, quote, want the women to be stuck with them because marriage is pretty good for men, unquote. Let's be real. The Republican Party, roiling as it is with divorcees, serial cheaters, and convicted sex offenders, can spare us the lectures on the sanctity of marriage. Nor do I buy that adding friction to the divorce process is what's best for children. This administration hasn't shown much interest in protecting children, poised as they are to slash funding for schools, for example. Besides, as the authors of this historical study of the idea that divorce hurts kids note, quote, most of the problems associated with being a child of divorce are instead related to sexism, racism, homophobia, shoddy record-keeping, and insufficient government support, unquote. I'll note, as a child of divorce myself, I experienced lots of scars and problems related to my parents' divorce, but I didn't experience any of those. It makes me go, But continuing. The movement against no-fault divorce is about walking back women's rights and autonomy. Even opponents of no-fault divorce don't claim that making divorce harder to obtain will lead to happier marriages or any change in men's behavior. As Anne Helen Peterson writes, our culture assumes that a miserable marriage is something that the wife, always the wife, can fix through some good old-fashioned grit and hard work. And it's inherently worth such grit and hard work. Not to get too Marxist here, but marriage serves a useful function in capitalist society. Much of our economy, from housing prices to child care availability, is designed around the unit of straight married couples. Of course, an administration devoted to shuttering social services wants to shore up the institution of marriage. The argument that marriage should be an ironclad contract, however, elides the actual reasons that couples in the modern age tend to get married. Most of us don't get married in order to protect extant social structures or to do our part to strengthen the economy. Most of us living secular lives live in this country and marry for love, seeking spouses we feel a romantic and soul-level connection with. I wasn't traded to my husband for some goods and a goat or two. We didn't expect to be in an advantageous match for our family's land holdings. The reason we got married was as squishy as it gets. We loved each other. It's the emotions, stupid. And why wouldn't we have married for love? No one has to prove anything in order to get married other than their desire to get married, not yet anyway. To get divorced, why should couples have to prove anything other than their desire to be unmarried? I got married because of a feeling, and I got divorced because of a feeling. I'm grateful that while my divorce wasn't unpleasant or easy, at least it didn't require me to lie. I didn't have to invent a crime to accuse my spouse or myself of, the way generations of people did before the advent of no-fault divorce. For us, no-fault divorce meant we could go to mediation together, attempt to have adult and caring conversations, and avoid a punishing, drawn-out court drama that would surely have distressed our children, drained our bank accounts, and nudged us into contempt for each other, as setting people on opposite sides of a battle tends to do. We were able to ethically end our marriage and move on to the next stages of our lives without unduly harming each other. Because you really can want out of a marriage and not hate the other person. In fact, being able to grasp nuance, to hold several ideas in your head at once, that is, I can't be married to this person anymore, and also I don't think he is a criminal or even a bad person, is, if anything, a sign of emotional intelligence, something I think we could all use a little more of. No-fault divorce allows for a civil proceeding guided by mutual respect, without accusations or undue legal drama, without hatred, without blame. No wonder the blamocracy questions its validity. In a time before no-fault divorce, my parents, and I'm talking now personally, my parents' divorce was nasty and traumatizing for me at 13. In a time of no-fault divorce in Texas, my divorce still took 21 months and cost me $100,000, which was borrowed from my mom. And I didn't even have to prove fault. And it took me over 10 years to get back to a zero net worth. Any Republican who thinks that divorce is too easy hasn't been through one. Modern Trumpist Republicanism is all about control and creating a world they think they'll like better, a world they'll no doubt try to exempt themselves from when it suits them. I only have time to read part of our final story, but I will be posting the whole thing along with the story link onto my show post. It's from TheGuardian.com. Quote, "I feel utter anger," unquote. From Canada to Europe, a movement to boycott U.S. goods is spreading. The renowned German classical violinist Christian Tetzlaff was blunt in explaining why he and his quartet have canceled a summer tour of the U.S. Quote, "There seems to be a quietness or denial about what's going on," Tetzlaff said, describing his horror at the authoritarian policies of Donald Trump and the response of U.S. elites to the country's growing democratic crisis. He continued by saying, quote, "I feel utter anger. I cannot go on with this feeling inside. I cannot just go and play a tour of beautiful concerts," unquote. A growing international move to boycott the U.S. is spreading from Scandinavia to Canada to the U.K. and beyond as consumers turn against U.S. goods. Most prominent so far has been the rejection of European car buyers of the Teslas produced by Elon Musk, now a prominent figure in Trump's administration as the head of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, a special group created by Trump that has contributed to the precipitous declines in Tesla's share price. About 15% of its value was wiped out on Monday alone. In Canada, where the American national anthem has been booed during hockey matches with U.S. teams, a slew of apps has emerged with names such as Buy Beaver, Maple Scan, and Is This Canadian to allow shoppers to scan QR barcodes and reject U.S. produce, from alcohol to pizza toppings. While boycotts have been a familiar tactic in the past, what's striking is how quickly the second Trump administration has become a target for both consumer anger and ethically minded companies. There's much more of this article, and I suggest clicking on the story link in this show post to read it. I cannot blame these countries for their anger and resentment toward the U.S. regime and its policies. I feel the same. I can only hope their actions will have some political benefit here as part of the resistance against our increasingly fascistic and authoritarian government. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 91.9 HD2. We are Houston's community media. I hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and I look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside.
What is dedication?
I think parents' job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov.
Hi, this is Lyle Lovett. I'd like to encourage you to support my hometown radio station, KPFT, in Houston. It's as easy as calling 713-526-5738 or donating online at kpft.org. Please, if you can, give to KPFT today. You'll be glad you did.
When you listen to the R&R Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3, you never know what you'll learn.
Why is it called the Beaver Moon, Tom?
Well, according to my research, because I'm a curious kind of guy, well, this is when beaver pelts were, shall we say, harvested, because they were at their furriest at this time of the year. And back when much of the American economy in the Northeast was predicated by success with beavers. And that's your history lesson for today.
Okay. All right.
It's all true. You want me to play a song?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. Beaver mania has overtaken me here.
Educational, maybe. Fun, definitely. Great music, yes.